Good morning, all. How's the sound? Does it seem good? Okay, I also have a cold, so my cough may be now amplified by this. So I apologize. I will try to turn my head, but I am just getting over a cold. So I teach the history of feminism in the United States, which is a vast and varied topic. It does not have a single narrative. It has many narratives. And I am happy to talk today about any of those narratives. I thought we might just quickly get a sense of what people came expecting to hear. I live, eat, and sleep this topic, so I can kind of go in whatever direction might be the audience. If you don't have a direction you want to go in, then I've got material, obviously, that I can just do. But I thought I would first just get a sense of if people came hoping to hear about something in particular, and I'll make sure that I cover that in today's talk. And also, I teach in a very interactive style in my classrooms, so if and when you have a question as we're going along, just raise your hand. We can make this very interactive. It doesn't need to be simply me talking at you. My daughter wanted to start the proceedings. This is my daughter, Aya, in the front seat here. And Aya, what couldn't women do in the olden days? Couldn't go to school and they couldn't vote. And were they the boss of their own bodies?
No.
No. And what do we think about that? There we go. Okay. That's my daughter's contribution. That's the 8-year-old version of this story. What from folks who came, what do you already know about this era and what were you hoping to learn about this era? I thought we'd talk about sort of the 19th century generally, which is, of course, 100 years. So it's a big span. But let's hear from, in the back. You want to hear a little myth busting? We can definitely do that. That's what's planned if we don't have a, okay. Yeah.
I've been sort of focused on racism, but trying to extrapolate the notion of white privilege and all that more generally. So I'm interested in language of power and unequal power relationship, how those in power become aware or sensitive to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Very important questions. Questions of race and racism in the movement, and also questions of white privilege. Is that a term that's kind of familiar to people? Okay. Other things? Yeah.
That was a time of a lot of social movements, and as I was reading it, sometimes they were competitive or didn't want certain people from other movements to participate and support their movement because they thought it might detract from it.
Yes, that is correct.
They didn't want some abolitionists to be a part of the women's movement because there was negative feelings in certain parts of the country about abolition.
Yeah, in any protest movement, someone decides what they think their most important issue is, and they find that people working on other issues is a detraction from the main goal. And so there's often a kind of inter-movement strife around where we should be focusing our energies, and that was certainly true in the 19th century. And I'll touch upon that too then. Anything else? Yeah.
Where do you think the future is for women?
Yeah, we can do prognostication together at the end if we would like to. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
One other thing that comes up in this space is the notion of intersectionality.
Yeah.
And so you're familiar with it.
Yep.
I was unfamiliar with it a couple of months ago. And kind of
yeah. Okay. I think when we get to race, racism, and white privilege, I'll bring up intersectionality, and we can talk all about that together kind of in a nugget in historical context in just a minute. That sounds good. Anything else? Yeah.
You mentioned it today, starting out. You're a historian, but you said the narrative. I'm not familiar with that in academic, especially in history. I'm an English major.
Yep. Okay. I'll talk about that today, too. Yep. Yeah. Yes, they were.
You only mentioned the women in the Constitution where it says we the people.
And a lot of people would argue that was meant to be white men. So a lot of people don't think the people actually includes women either. Women are never mentioned in the Constitution. Sex is mentioned, and sex in the sense of one's biological identity, not in, you know, the kind of 60s radicals. Sex revolution, but is only mentioned in the 19th Amendment. So sex only appears once in the Constitution, and the 19th Amendment says states may not discriminate in voting based on sex. That's the so-called woman suffrage amendment, which we can talk more about. But that has been part of the reason why people have wanted to push the ERA, is to make there to be some constitutional basis where gender discrimination is actually a problem. Whereas historically, the courts have ruled that gender discrimination is actually reasonable. So I'm going to do a bit of a book talk then, because what all of you asked about would fit into a topic. So let me just go. I brought a lot of different things. Let's start here. There is a story, and this goes to the question that some of you had about narrative. There is a story about women's rights in the United States. And one of the things about stories, and this is what I meant about narrative, is that stories are interpretive. And stories are not always just true. Stories are always a selection of facts. They are not all of the facts. Because all stories have to be selective. You can't include everything. And one of the things about history is we often think about it as just going into the past, finding the story, the truth, and then just telling it. And in fact, every time anyone goes back into the past and selects certain facts to tell, you automatically leave things out and you automatically include things. You prioritize certain things in your story, you de-emphasize other things in your story, and every time you do that, you make an argument. And that argument includes a kind of form of power. You're saying, this is how I want people now to understand the past. And so being able to narrate about the past, being able to tell stories, is itself a form of power. And history is really about argument making, about making an argument about what the past meant, not just transparently telling what the past meant. Now, that's a kind of preamble, and hopefully through the talk today, that will become more sensical. So we'll get to that in just a minute. So what I'm going to start with is the canonical story for where women's rights comes from in the United States, and that's the story of Seneca Falls. And that story tells that there was a young woman named Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who you see there holding her young baby, who settles in Seneca Falls, New York, which is there in the Finger Lakes, the red dot there in western New York, just south of Rochester, New York. And she is there birthing babies, and she's a new mother, recently married, and she is a prodigious intellect. She comes from a reformist family. She married an abolitionist. And she had, years earlier, met the woman to the left there, Lucretia Mott, who is about 20 years her senior. Lucretia Mott was a veteran abolitionist and women's rights activist. Some of you may know that in the abolition movement, there were a lot of women in the kind of immediate end of slavery, and this would have been in the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. There were lots of women in the abolitionist movement, and a lot of them started speaking out against slavery. And when they did that, they were resoundingly chastised by churches, by politicians, for stepping outside their sphere, for speaking publicly while being a female, which was considered scandalous because women were supposed to remain quiet, they were supposed to exert their influence passively, and they were supposed to stay kind of in the home. And so what happened is women's rights kind of emerged accidentally, in some ways, out of abolition, because women started saying, I have every right to stand here and speak about abolition as a female. So what started to happen is women started in the abolitionist movement to start to defend their rights as women, to be out in the public campaigning for something. And a women's rights movement, people often talk about being born out of the abolitionist movement. And this is a case here where Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton had met in London in 1840, this 8 years prior to this, when Mott had come over to the World's Anti-Slavery Convention. In London, and the United States sent a delegation that was co-ed. It had women and men in it. And when that delegation arrived in Britain, the English were appalled that the United States had sent women, and sort of said, women can't participate in this proceeding. That's ridiculous. And so they had a full debate the very first day that devolved just about women's rights. Could women be seated on the floor, and could they take part in the convention? Mott was there as a delegate. Stanton was there on her honeymoon. She was just a bystander. But what they decide, this is sort of, is that women can participate, but they have to sit behind a curtain so that they can't be seen and they can't talk. They may passively listen behind a curtain. And as you might imagine, a lot of the U.S. women were quite outraged by this. And Stanton and Mott met on that take and, as the story goes, declared right then and there out of their fury they were going to come home and hold a convention on women's wrongs. And then there's this 8-year gap in the story. And as the story goes, then Stanton comes back, starts her new married life, has kids, is living in Seneca Falls. Lucretia Mott comes through one day with her sister, kind of visiting in the area. They all hold a tea at a woman's house named Jane McClintock, or Jane Hunt, and they decide right then and there that they're going to finally hold the convention that they've been meaning to hold all these years. And so they put an advertisement in the paper, and 3 days later, they hold the very first women's rights convention in the United States. It is today, that convention is today often interpreted as the beginning of a women's rights movement in the United States. And what my book talks about is what that story does, and we'll talk more about that in just a little bit. But it is true that it was the very first women's rights convention in the United States. It is true that it took place in July in 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York. It is not necessarily true, right? It's a story that someone has to agree upon that began a women's rights movement, and that's what we'll talk. That's what my book's about, is where does the story about Seneca Falls as the beginning come from, not the event itself? And this will all make more sense as we go through the session today. So they spend 2 days debating the question of women's rights, and they write a manifesto called the Declaration of Sentiments, and they model it on the U.S. Declaration of Independence, clearly hearkening to that kind of language. And they start, and they, the usual preamble to the Declaration, including, "We hold these rights to be self-evident, that all men," and they insert, "and women, are created equal." And then they list a bunch of grievances instead of the king against men, and then they have a series of demands. And the demands include a whole wide variety of things. But they are, to go to the question that the gentleman in the back had, they are generally concerns that white middle-class women have. They are not the concerns of all women. And so it's a mistake when we think of this as a women's rights platform. Really, it's a platform that speaks to the interests of white middle-class women. But nonetheless, hugely important, right? I don't mean to diminish that just so much as to think about the limits of it. They demand, for example, that women have the right to own and hold property, because women at this time could not own or hold property, which meant they had absolutely no independent economic life. They had to marry and be attached to a man. They demand access to the professions. They want to be able to become teachers. They want to become lawyers. They want to become ministers. They want access to equal education. At this point, women can't go to the same schools that boys go to, and they're educated differently. They're educated in sort of needlepoint and housewifery, not, chemistry and Latin. They want dress reform. Some of you may know the Victorian women wore middle-course women wore lots of corsets and long petticoats and things like that, and often they were carrying 30 to 40 pounds on their frame. It made it very difficult to do things. Sometimes their internal organs got rearranged from the tightness of the petticoats. And they also demand that women get the right to the elective franchise. And this is often also said to be the beginning of the women's first demand for the vote. And Stanton includes the right to the elective franchise. She demands that it be put in, and it is the only demand at Seneca Falls that is not passed unanimously. Everything else passes unanimously. The people, about 300 people show up for this thing. It was just locally announced, but about 300 people show up, and they vote on every declaration after they debate it. And the vote does not pass immediately. And some of you may know Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist from who was living at the time in Rochester, New York. He was an escaped slave, and he is at this point a very prominent abolitionist. He will go on very quickly in a couple more years to become the leading African-American statesman in the United States. But he is at this point still a relatively recently escaped slave and a growing and prominent abolitionist. And he is at the convention because he lives in just up the road in Rochester, New York. And he stands and gives a passionate defense of the women's right to vote. And it passes, but not unanimously, but it does pass in the end. Now, bookmark that, because we're going to get to a very painful moment later where Stanton and Douglass have not a kind of collaborative relationship like they did here. Okay, so that's the canonical story. That's the conventional story about where women's rights begins in the United States. And as the story goes, women sort of march forth and sort of, demand all these things and get them, one by one. Although one of the things that's remarkable is how many of the demands they make at Seneca Falls we still don't have. Women's equal pay. Women's equal access to the professions. I mean, there's quite a bit we've won, but what's remarkable is in some ways how little has been won. Yeah.
National declaration, or was there scope there in locality?
Oh, so the convention is very local, but then they print copies of the manifesto and they start sending it around the country. And remember, a lot of these people who are at this convention are abolitionists who are already deeply involved in national reform networks. So those national reform networks that are the abolitionist movement become the same channels that the women's rights movement uses, and then it starts to develop its own channels. So after this, women start holding women's rights conventions all around the Midwest and the Northeast. This does not go into the South, and later we can talk about why, but it's really through the Midwest and the Northeast. And women's rights conventions start being held kind of everywhere. By 1850, they're holding national women's rights conventions where the states send delegates. The very first one is in Worcester, Massachusetts, in 1850. They hold women's rights conventions, annual great big ones, every year until 1860 when the Civil War breaks out, and then they suspend them and fight for the war and for turning the war into one of emancipation. So a lot of people say this is sort of the beginning of the women's rights movement. I don't have time today to talk about all the other things that were happening. This was not the first women's rights action. There were lots of women's rights activities going on. So why pick this one as the beginning is sort of an interesting question to me, because there are lots of different things you could pick. But this is the story, and there is a U.S. National Historical Park there today in Seneca Falls. You can go tour the chapel where it took place, go to the visitor center, go visit Stanton's home. It's a national park site, and it was the very first national park site to be dedicated to women's rights. So it is a kind of pilgrimage that many people make to go to Seneca Falls and kind of go to the birthplace. Any questions at this point? All right, so that's kind of the canonical story. And now let me tell you about the book that I wrote, which was about where did that story, what's the history of the story? Because stories don't just present themselves. People have to decide to tell a story, and they have to decide to adopt a story, and they have to decide to repeat a story. This is the park. The chapel has since been closed up. There's the Declaration of Sentiments on a black granite wall, and water kind of pours over. Just a second. I need you to put your hand down and listen, okay? All right, thanks. This is the book I wrote. I was curious where that story came from, because what I found out is that nobody in the antebellum period, which is the pre-Civil War period, is telling the story of Seneca Falls. Nobody in that era says, you know, this all began at Seneca Falls. People don't start saying that until after the American Civil War in the 1870s. So I wondered to myself, why are they starting to talk about that in the 1870s? Like, what's going on? What is the history of that story? Where did we get this story? And what I found, and what I call my book, The Myth of Seneca Falls, is not saying that Seneca Falls is false, so much as it is both an event and it is a story. And we need to have a history and an understanding of both. And so the myth, what I argue, is a kind of organized, it's a story that's greater than just a random story. It's a story that elevates to the level of a myth, meaning it gives order to the universe. It is something that gives deep meaning to. Okay, so let's fast forward to why, after the American Civil War, I argue people started telling this story. We met Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who's here in the white curls. She was the one who was at Seneca Falls as a young new mother. A couple years later, how many of you knew the story of Seneca Falls? A couple, okay. How many of you would have thought Susan B. Anthony was there? Yeah, she wasn't. And it's an interesting story I tell in my book about how she gets placed there. She was not there. She only meets Stanton 3 years later in Seneca Falls, New York. They meet in 1851. She lives up the road in Rochester, New York. Stanton's just down the road in Seneca Falls, New York. And they meet in 1851, and they become best friends, and really the most probably dynamic and productive and important friendship of the 19th century in many ways. They will go on to be the leaders in the movement, and they are perfectly compatible. The shortcomings in one are complemented by the strengths in the other. Stanton was the prodigious intellect, the thinker, the writer, the philosopher. Anthony really has none of those qualities. She hates to write. She's not much of it, but she's a consummate organizer. And so what would happen is that Anthony would organize everything, and then she would go lock Stanton up in a room and take care of her kids, because, of course, Anthony never marries and doesn't have any kids, and say, write an address. We need an address. We need a manifesto, blah, blah, blah. I'll take care of the kids. You go in that room, and don't come out until you have it written. And so they had this really lovely friendship, whereby one was the, sort of contributed the thoughts and the thing, and the other sort of contributed the organizational energies. And they would go on to be friends for the rest of their life and be in some ways inseparable. It almost becomes impossible to talk about them separately. And when Stanton dies in 1902, she asks nothing more than a framed picture of Susan B. Anthony be on her coffin. I mean, that just sort of tells you a little bit about the dynamic friendship that they had. And it's an interesting story I tell in my book about how today we remember Anthony, but we don't tend to remember Stanton. And I tell that story in my book about how that memory got created. But I won't go into that today. I brought a variety of things because I didn't know just what we would talk about. Let's go here. After the American Civil War, when the war ends, abolition has been won, right? The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution ends slavery in the United States at the close of the United States Civil War. And a lot of the abolitionist movement is wondering to themselves, well, what should we do now, right? Should we, are we done? Should we demand basic civil rights? Because being free doesn't mean anything because it has no legal status. At this point, freed people are not even citizens of the United States because of the Dred Scott decision. Freed people are in a legal limbo. They are not covered by the U.S. Constitution. They have no rights. They are free, but what does that mean? What does freedom mean, ultimately? So part of what the abolition movement does is reorganize after the American Civil War and demand voting rights for freed people. And they organize in something known as the American Equal Rights Association, which is a biracial co-ed organization that demands two things, voting rights for women and voting rights for African Americans. Do you notice who gets dropped out of that equation? Huh? Who? No, voting rights for women and voting rights for African Americans. They want both. Well, they don't. Yeah, that's a difference. Well, what happens, too, is that women start to be presumed to be white, and African-Americans starts to presume to be men, and black women get kind of lost in the story, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But so they demand that there be both of these. And the U.S. Congress is not so convinced that they want to pass both of these, but the U.S. Congress, for a variety of complicated reasons, does decide that it's going to pass voting rights for African-American citizens. And that's the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And the 15th Amendment says you may not discriminate in voting on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So it does not say African Americans have the right to vote. It just says you can't discriminate on those bases, which for a while gives them the right to vote. But then, as you know, what will the South start to say? We'll discriminate on the basis of poll taxes. We'll discriminate on the basis of literacy tests. And all that's compatible with the 15th Amendment. But that jumps ahead. When the U.S. Congress passes the 15th Amendment, the American Equal Rights Association is on the horns of a dilemma. Is this a goal? Is this a glass half full or a glass half empty? Right? It's half of what they demanded. It's not voting rights for women, but it is voting rights for African Americans, or at least African American men. And so they meet in their 1869 convention in New York City, and a horrible fight breaks out. And the fight breaks out really primarily between Frederick Douglass, who was there, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And what happens is Stanton and Anthony decide they are not going to support the 15th Amendment. They say, basically, this is going to put ignorant Sambos in charge of educated, refined white womanhood. The racism in their language is astonishing. They talk about the ignorant Negroes and the Sambos. They use all kinds of racial epithets. And they basically say that they will never have ignorant Negro manhood ruling over educated, refined white womanhood. And it's a very ugly moment. And as you can imagine, a lot of their abolitionist allies are appalled. Because for them to speak, A, that racistly about African Americans, and B, to deny them this important civil right when they are being lynched and killed and burned to death in the South after the American Civil War is appalling to them. And it's appalling to Frederick Douglass, who's there as well. And Frederick Douglass says, Stanton, you know, this, our lives are at stake here. And he basically says, like, we're being hunted through the streets in the South. You can't pretend that this isn't an immediate need. And Stanton says, no, I will never support this. And it's a really ugly moment in U.S. history. And Anthony says the same. And Stanton and Anthony bolt from the organization, and they form their new organization called the National Woman Suffrage Association, which opposes the 15th Amendment and only supports white woman suffrage, or woman suffrage, what they presume to be white. Lucy Stone, who's somebody you may or may not have heard of, and I talk about how she gets forgotten in my book too, she's also a leading reformer. She was lecturing on women's rights before Seneca Falls. Like she's, and she is an abolitionist and women's rights activist. She will be one of the first women to take an equal college degree with men. She will study and learn Greek so that she can read the original Bible and determine that men perverted it and, you know, made it oppressive to women when it shouldn't have been. And she will, with a variety of other people from the American Equal Rights Association, including most African Americans, form the American Women's Suffrage Association. And so in 1869, the U.S. national suffrage movement is born divided, and it's divided on the question of race, to go to your question earlier. Then Stanton and Anthony go on to do a variety of other really racist and elitist things, and their allies are appalled and shocked. And so they're having some PR trouble. And one of the things I argue in my book, let's see if we should go, let's go here though. There's already this big split in the movement. And then along comes a woman named Victoria Woodhull. How many people have heard of Victoria Woodhull? Any questions at this point? Okay, so along comes Victoria Woodhull. And if things had been bad for Stanton and Anthony to start with, they're about to get a lot worse. Victoria Woodhull she's a clairvoyant, which in the 19th century a lot of people believed and really thought was quite scientific, that there were certain people who had skills to be able to talk to the dead. They could put the dead in communication with the living. And the Ouija board, which probably your kids or you played with when you were in junior high, that was considered a serious scientific instrument that was used by clairvoyants in the 19th century. So she's a clairvoyant. She is comes from kind of a charlatan family, a guy who traveled around the country, her dad, who sort of sold sham medicine and then would be run out of town and then would go to the next town and kind of sell his daughter's clairvoyant skills and sham medicine. But anyway, she and her sister, Tennessee Claflin, show up in New York City, and they're known to be sort of prominent clairvoyants, but they're not at all elite. But Cornelius Vanderbilt, the great railroad magnate and millionaire, has lost his wife, and he's desperate to talk to her. She's dead. And so he finds out that there's this clairvoyant who's come to town named Victoria Woodhull, and he goes to her, or she comes to him, I don't know who goes to who, and she puts him in touch with his dead wife, and he is unbelievably pleased to have been able to talk with his dead wife. And so he starts showering gifts upon Victoria Woodhull and her sister, Tennessee Claflin. He gives them a Wall Street brokerage firm on Wall Street. It's the very first brokerage firm ever owned and organized by women. He gives them a newspaper, the Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, in which they start publishing all kinds of radical reform information, including women's rights, and including they publish the first English translation of the Communist Manifesto. They do labor rights. They do all kinds of things in the Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly. Now, the sisters then very quickly rise from kind of obscurity to prominence. And then Victoria Woodhull is invited to come speak before the U.S. Congress on women's suffrage. And Stanton and Anthony are like, who? What? They didn't invite, they're inviting who? Right? Like, what is the deal that she's getting invited to do this? She had a friend in the Congress. So Stanton and Anthony go to hear her address before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee on women's suffrage and are so taken with her, and they invite her into their organization, the National. And things are going along okay for a while, but then Woodhull is a bit of a renegade, right? And she decides that she does not like the sanctimony of the white men in the movement who are, you know, she's also, oh, I forgot to mention, she's also a free lover. She's a sex radical. So we think of sex radicals as being only something that happened in the 20th century, but there were plenty in the 19th century. She believes women should be able to take and discard lovers at their will. She believes women ought to be able to divorce. She believes women should be able to say no to men. I mean, there's this whole movement called sex radicals called free lovers, and she's a free lover as well. And so a lot of people in the American side of the movement, right, the American Lucy Stone's organization, which is much more conservative, is appalled that Victoria Woodhull's been invited into the organization. They believe she's going to bring disrepute onto the movement. Yeah. She's fine. She's pro civil rights. Yeah. Yeah. She does stick out like a sword. She's a very interesting woman. She gets even more interesting. Just wait. It's like the best sex scandal of the 19th century. So anyway, so she becomes really annoyed because all these leading white men in the suffrage movement who are, you know, all sanctimonious, including some of them are ministers, are sort of pillaring her for her irrepute and her immorality. And she's like, they're a bunch of hypocrites, because she knows that Henry Ward Beecher, see if I brought up, no, I didn't bring a slide of him, Henry Ward Beecher, who's the nation's leading minister, brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who writes Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Catherine Beecher, sister of Catherine Beecher, the kind of Martha Stewart of the 19th century. He is, everyone knows, sleeping with his parishioners and having an affair with his best friend's wife. Like, this is common knowledge, but it's not the thing you would ever talk about in the 19th century publicly, unless you're Victoria Woodhull. And Victoria Woodhull decides, Henry Ward Beecher won't appear on a stage with me because I'm supposedly immoral. He's sleeping with his best friend's wife. I'm going to publish that on the front of my paper. So she publishes it on the cover of the Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, and it causes pandemonium in the United States. I mean, pandemonium. And it unleashes a 2-year trial of Henry Ward Beecher for adultery, which was a crime. And then there's a criminal trial, there's a civil trial. I mean, it's a huge mess. And not only this, Victoria Woodhull, never being shy of controversy, also decides that she's going to declare herself in 1872 as candidate for the U.S. presidency. She's the first woman to ever run for president. And she runs on the Cosmo Political Party, the Equal Rights Party. She declares Frederick Douglass her running mate, but she never checks with Frederick Douglass about this. And Frederick Douglass is like, no, I'm not running with Victoria Woodhull. anyway, she loses. And right around the same time in 1872 is when she also publishes, October, 2 weeks before the presidential election, is when she publishes The Affair. So everything kind of blows up at the end of 1872. Yeah. Yeah.
Or was she advocating for promiscuity, or both?
She was not advocating for promiscuity, but she was advocating for the fact that women should have a right to practice their sexuality with control over how they practice it. Right now, women had no control over their bodies. There was no... Women just had to submit to men whenever they were around. And there was an idea in the 19th century that women didn't have a sexuality. They had something called a maternal instinct, and men had a sexuality. And she said, no, that's ridiculous. Women also can practice and enjoy sex, but they ought to be able to do it on their own terms. They ought to have some autonomy over it. So she's not just wantonly advocating for promiscuity so much as women have an intentional and fully partnership role in their own sexuality, including the right to say yes and the right to say no. So anyway, things explode, and as you can imagine, once she does this, accuses the nation's most, and by the way, he gets off, he's acquitted, right, which to her is a total example of the sexual double standard, right? Men can get away with all this stuff, and women, you know, ill repute is visited upon them. Meanwhile, people start, because of Victoria Woodhull and because of this whole sex scandal, start saying the suffrage movement is nothing more than a bunch of free lovers, right? So all this bad publicity rains down on the suffrage movement at the end of 1872, and Lucy Stone and her colleagues, back in the American Association, which is a much bigger organization, are like, these women are causing so much trouble, right? Stanton and Anthony just keep bringing bad news upon the movement. They're attacking the 15th Amendment. They're behaving in racist fashion. They're bringing this ill repute into this woman. They're causing all this trouble. And it is conveniently, right after this, in January, here's a slide of the... This became like the nation was consumed by the sex war. So here was a pamphlet you could buy called The Beecher and Tilton Wars, and priced 25 cents. You could read all about it, right? Stanton and Anthony, then at the beginning of 1873, are kind of on the horns of a dilemma, right? They're like, all this bad press is raining down on them and down upon the movement. And they need something to kind of rescue their situation. They need a ray of sunshine, right? They don't have much. And what do? They hold a convention in 1873 for the very first time to celebrate the 25th anniversary of Seneca Falls. It's the first time anyone's ever done such a thing. And no one ever had been saying that the movement began in Seneca Falls prior to this. People dated the movement to all kinds of influences at the beginning of the 19th century. Even Mott herself didn't date it to 1848. But suddenly in 1873, Stanton and Anthony hold a convention, and they say women's rights began here in 1848. And they will popularize and tell that story for the rest of their careers. They will hold anniversary conventions. They will write a multi-volume history of their own movement in which they will center Seneca Falls, and in which Stanton will suggest she met Anthony in 1848, starting to put Anthony at Seneca Falls, even though she wasn't really there. When they publish this history, a lot of their friends are quite astonished and upset. They basically say that they're making up a lot of facts, but today it's just treated as a kind of transparent, true document. But it has a very strong argument that the movement began in Seneca Falls. Now, why does that argument serve them in 1873? Can anyone here think about... Yep. And there are lots of good things that this story does, which we can get to too, but there are also some bad things that it does. And branding is, yeah. Can other people think of why this is suddenly convenient for them to start telling the story? Right. So let's go back here. The National Association is coming apart at the seams. It is flying apart. It is bringing all kinds of ill repute on the organization. The American Association is doing much better. It is now starting to take on the mantle of leadership in the movement, which Stanton and Anthony, to go to the question earlier about factionalism, there are some differences in terms of how each side is pursuing the vote, and Stanton and Anthony think the other side has the wrong strategy. And if they take over the movement will crash and burn. So they want themselves to be in charge of the movement. They want their version of pursuing the vote through the federal amendment. So what they start doing is arguing the movement began at Seneca Falls. Now, who was at Seneca Falls? Stanton. Was Lucy Stone or any of those other people in the American Association there? No. Anthony wasn't there either, but at this point, she's such a good friend of Stanton's that she gets kind of grandfathered into the story. If they can start the movement at Seneca Falls, then history points a direct line of succession to Stanton. If they start the movement somewhere else, like many people at the time talked about Worcester, that first national women's rights convention in 1850 as the beginning of the movement, that Stanton and Anthony weren't there. They weren't at the beginning in 1850. That points a direct line of succession to Stone, who was at that organization, right? Presumably, if that's where history began, and if that's what history is, then if Stanton birthed feminism, then isn't anything she does in the present, by definition, still the proper feminism? Does that make sense, what I'm saying? That's what I mean by stories have power, when you were asking earlier about narratives. So what they start to do is tell this story. And not only that, they will continue to really propagate this story over the rest of their careers. And in the history of women's suffrage, here... they go so far, when they tell the story of 1869 and the really painful racism in the movement and the split, you know what they call the other side? Secessionists. Which is not a word you throw around lightly after the American Civil War. To say that about somebody is to say something incredibly damning. And they say, in 1869, there was a secession in our ranks, they say in this book. Which... is my right, and the only way that works is if the story comes from Seneca Falls forward and they break from Stanton and Anthony. Stanton and Anthony are the true vein of the movement, and anybody who doesn't follow them are the ones who seceded. When really, who broke away in 1869? It was Stanton and Anthony who broke away in 1869. Everybody else was kind of in the same channel. And to go to your question earlier about intersectionality, which we should talk about right here, for a lot of black women, the National Association does not represent their interests at all. And there were black women at the American Equal Rights Association who say in 1869, we are all bound up together. We cannot talk about this as a question of priority of one over the other. And the idea of intersectionality is that you cannot, and this is something the feminist movement learned through great pains over the 1870s, or 1970s, and even then, that you cannot separate out gender. Gender is not one thing, and you can't separate it out as like. So you can't say this is what women need, and then whatever else they need, they go deal with that. Because what women need is really different based on who you are. If you're a woman who's poor, living on a Native American reservation, what you're going to need is different than what a young woman needs who's, you know, going to Yale and is, you know, 17 and whatever. So intersectionality is the idea that multiple identities are mutually constructed, and you have to pay attention to a variety of... So, for example, let me just give you one example. Here's an example of intersectionality. Battered women's movement basically says, we'll get back to the story in just a minute. Battered Mormon says, okay, if there's battery, what you need to do is call the police, and they will come and provide protection for you, right? Okay, that's a common solution that sort of feminism pioneered in the 1970s, right? We need to make this against the law. We need you to be able to call upon the law. What that doesn't take into account is that the fact for many people of color, calling the law is not something that's safe, right? Do you see what I'm saying? So you think, you're like, well, this is what women need. They need the protection of the law, without thinking about the ways in which other women experience that reality incredibly differently. And for African Americans, for example, calling upon the law means that when they show up, somebody might get shot, right? Somebody might die. Somebody is much more likely to be incarcerated, that man. And maybe you don't want that man incarcerated, than a white man's likely to be incarcerated. We have an epidemic of mass incarceration in the United States. 1 in 3 black men in the United States can expect to be incarcerated in the span of their lifetime. That is astonishing. So that's what I mean by, you can't assume that there's a one-size-fit-all solution to gender problems. You have to think through the ways in which different people experience a reality. And when you hear people talking today about intersectionality, that's the idea. And what intersectionality is, both a call to inclusion and kind of robust thinking, it's also a critique. And the ways in which intersectionality is a critique is by saying, white middle-class women have been presuming for a long time to be the voice of the movement, and they've been presuming that whatever they need is what everybody needs. And what they're not paying attention to is how the things they're advocating aren't necessarily helpful to me. Does that make sense? So it's both a kind of call for inclusion and a different approach, and a critique of the ways in which the feminist movement has centered white middle-class women's concerns and solutions over the solutions and the problems of other people of other identities. And that was true in the 19th century. Like I said, at that famous 1869 meeting, a woman named Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, an African-American woman, basically says, we cannot have this fight over priority, that we are all bound up together, she says in a very famous phrase, which was an intersectional critique before intersectionality existed. But black women have been making intersectional critiques all their life, right? It just doesn't get labeled until the 20th century. And Stanton and Anthony will have mixed things going forward on race. So anyway, let me go to this slide to come back to the story. Any questions at this point about... One of the things that happens is the story at first, nobody even knows the story of Seneca Falls when they start telling it in 1873. In 1873, when they hold this convention and say, they have to basically narrate their whole story about Seneca Falls because no one's ever heard it before, right? And a lot of the people who joined the movement came in after the American Civil War. They don't know anything about what happened 40 years ago, or 25 years ago, right? This is all new to them. So Stanton and Anthony start marketing this story. They reprint the Declaration of Sentiments and the proceedings from this and start circulating them so that there's a kind of documentary evidence. And they do a number of other things, which I talk about in the book. But one of the other things they do is that in writing this massive history of women's suffrage, which is in fact an incredibly valuable and incredibly amazing document, they were writing women's history at a time when nobody was writing women's history, believing that women deserved a record of their past and that a record of their past could serve them. And I applaud that, and I love that about this project because I am a women's historian. I believe that we need our past in order to serve ourselves in figuring out how to move forward. So it is a remarkable and gorgeous and brilliant production. It takes them 10 years to do it. They pull out their hair. The writing of it is unbelievable. It is, in fact, a biased document, as all documents are. But I don't think it necessarily is useless because it's biased. It only centers the national. It centers their story. The American and their long history of activism is put into a final chapter in the second volume that almost reads like an appendix, and they're called nothing more, this is the language, nothing more than a state-level organization, which is, of course, not true. But the national is elevated. And going forward, the national will start to become the movement. The national and the American will merge in 1890 and become the National American Woman Suffrage Association. which is what people often call NAWSA, N-A-W-S-A, the acronym people pronounce it, National American Woman's Suffrage Association. The National American will have its own history of racism and discrimination, but this is Anthony in her attic. After the when the merger happens, Anthony, and I tell this story in my book, so I should say here that, and you may be feeling this way as well, some people have criticized me for being too hard on Anthony and Stanton. And people are welcome to make whatever criticisms they want. My sense has been that we have had such a sanctified view of these two that we actually don't do them historical credit because we don't remember them in their 3D complexity that they were, and that they were not saints, that they had foibles, that they were ambitious, that they were savvy politicians, right? Are all things we would expect in men, but things we don't, I still think, very comfortably accept in women. And so I think the ways in which, in my book, Stanton and Anthony, one of the things they do, for example, at the unification in 1890 is that they call a kind of undemocratic vote in order to put Stanton and Anthony at the head of the organization because they want to be in charge, because they believe their vision is the best vision for women. It's not just that they're self-aggrandizing. They really believe that women's equality rests on them being in charge because they know the right way. And they do some pretty undemocratic things in my book, things that you would not expect from people advocating for a kind of democracy. But my sense is we do them much more service if we remember them in their full 3D character and not as these kind of cartoonish saints. But, you know, we can talk about that more if you want. And this is where I'm about to get hard on Anthony again. Anthony builds this massive archive in her third floor of her attic. And in her attic in her home in Seneca Falls is really the biggest women's history repository that has ever existed in the 19th century. It won't exist again really until the 1950s and 60s when Schlesinger starts to build the sort of first women's history archive. They, over the course of their writing of the history of woman suffrage, Anthony then goes on and commissions a fourth volume, and then she has a three-volume authorized biography written of herself. These were people who understood the power of the written word, right, the power of history. And by the end of the 19th century, by 1898, or by 1888, Lucy Stone will start saying, and Lucy, I should say, by the way, Lucy Stone hates all this remembering. She thinks it detracts from the cause. So Stanton will write her and they'll say, please send us your letters and things like that so that we can include them in our book. And she'll like buzz off. You know, she's like, I'm not going to send you my things, A, because I don't trust you, and B, can you get to work? You know, like, we have work to do. What are you doing writing all this history? You know, but they also understood that history was incredibly powerful and women needed a legacy in order to keep fighting. They started to understand that this was not going to be one in their lifetimes. And one of the things that they felt could keep propelling the movement forward was some sense of where it had come from. And there's something incredibly beautiful about that, right? What a gift to give to the movement and to give to kind of future women's generations is this legacy of where they've been. I mean, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous book in so many ways. But Stanton will then write an authorized biography, and it goes on. I mean, their scholarly and historical production is astonishing. Anthony is really the greatest women's historian of the 19th century, but we never remember her that way. And I really believe that her role as a historian was deeply linked to her role as an activist. But this is them producing in the attic. They have collected letters over the years, over these productions, over 20, 30 years. They write people and say, please send us your letters. Please send us all your programs. Please send us all your ephemera. Right? Because no one's keeping this stuff. And they have this massive attic in Anthony's, massive archive in Anthony's attic. And what do you suppose happens to it at the end of Anthony's life? Hmm? I heard a lot of murmuring, but I couldn't quite make it out. Sorry. Anthony burns it. Yeah, Anthony burns it. She approves the burning of it. Not all of it got burned, and we don't know what in it got burned, but the fires burned all day for 2 weeks. They first started burning everything in the furnace, but the furnace proved inadequate for the quantity of stuff that needed to be burned, so they started setting bonfires in her backyard, and they did this for 2 weeks. Why would a woman that committed to historical preservation and historical documentation over the course of her life burn everything?
She wanted her side of the story preserved and no one else's.
Yes, that's what I think too. And she says in her authorized biography, which remember I said she hates to write, so she's hired this other woman sitting at the table here to write it for her. That's Ida Husted Harper. But she says in the advertising for her 3-volume biography, this is the only historical, this is the only authentic account that can ever exist because future records will not be available to future historians. I mean, it says that in the advertisement, right? So you're like, this woman's going to burn that much stuff? And surely some of it, anyone who's ever written a book knows you have a lot of stray paper at the end that needs to be destroyed. So I'm not saying all of it was valuable documentation. And indeed, we don't know what got burned. But she burns a ton of stuff. And you think to yourself, this is a woman who was going to make sure that her narrative was the narrative. And in everything she writes, she is the center of the movement. And again, I don't think that's egomaniacal sort of behavior. I think it's because she really believed that she had the key to helping women win. The suffragists had very different visions about how they ought to achieve suffrage and what suffrage ought to be. And Anthony really believed that women's freedom depended on her vision. Do you want me to say, I know we have about 10 more minutes, is that about right? So I have a variety of different things I could say. I could take us forward to kind of the winning of the 19th Amendment, which is coming up, the 2020 anniversary of coming up. I could sort of take some questions. We could talk some more about this. Do the questions that you asked kind of at the beginning, have they been kind of roughly answered by your myth-busting got, the kind of racism question? I can say more about kind of race in the movement. Yeah.
I'm going to say this wrong, but
the who? Grimke, G-R-I-M-K-E. The Grimke sisters are here. They sure were. They sure were. I brought pictures of them. I didn't know if the Grimkes would come up. There are the Grimkes. They look really sour, don't they? They were apparently awesome, but this does not do them very much justice. Unfortunately, too, you go back into the first part of the 19th century and you don't have photography, right? So you get these like weird drawings of people. But
were they kind of like too old?
Sorry about that. No, so a little bit about the Grimke sisters. Do you want to learn about the Grimkes? Grimke sisters are two sisters who come from a slave-owning family in South Carolina. They come from a very wealthy, ritzy family. And in the 19th century, in the 1820s and the 1830s, there was this thing called the Second Great Awakening in the United States, which was this period of religious revivalism. It's when a lot of new religions get born. And the idea was, before, people had thought that God determined one's salvation, right? This was sort of the Calvinist doctrine. God determined your salvation. You were not in charge of your own salvation. And with the Second Great Awakening, one of the things that changed was you were in charge of your own salvation. It was up to you to live as perfect a life as possible in God's eyes so that you could be saved. And it was up to you. And with that came a whole variety of new religions because people started saying, if it's up to me, I better make sure I make some pretty wise choices, right? I better make sure I'm following the proper word of God, because there were all kinds of different religious denominations preaching slightly different versions of what God's word was and what God's path was. A lot of different religions are born at this time kind of saying this is actually what God intended, the most famous of them being Mormonism, right? Mormonism is born in this era of Second Great Awakening because Joseph Smith, who is racking his soul to try to make sure that he's following the right path to God, because he's in charge of his own salvation now, goes into the forest, falls to his knees, and prays to God and said, please show me the right path. And God appears to him in the form of Angel Moroni, and the angel appears before Joseph Smith and says, none of these are the right path to God, because there is a lost scripture. And it is over there in that hillside, and I will go with you, and we will dig it up. And that is the Book of Mormon. And basically says, this is the right path to God, right? So there was this period of religious... But one of the other things that follows from this is if you can perfect yourself, by extension, people start realizing you can perfect society. And aren't women who are moral, upstanding beings responsible for going out and saving society? Right, with their heightened morality. Isn't this God's will? And this is what starts to lead to a whole lot of reform movements at the beginning of the 19th century. And the reason women are involved in these reform movements is they believe that it is God's calling to them to go out and perfect the world, to eliminate the sins that exist in society. And what people think those sins are varies, right? So some people think the most offensive sin in the eyes of God is slavery. Other people think the most offensive sin in the eyes of God is ill-temperance, like over-drinking. Other people think it's prostitution, right? So all these reform movements start. And the Grimke sisters, just to come back, that was kind of all context, are two women who are racked in this. They are racked by their moral conscience about what is the right way to God. And they are searching for the right way to God. And they go north. They leave South Carolina and go north to hear a lot of the preachers that are moving around the north. And while they're there, they convert to Quakerism. They believe that that is the proper path to salvation. And the little bonnets that they wear there, which you also saw that Lucretia Mott had on, are Quaker bonnets. Just like today you would recognize an Amish by the way they would dress, in the 19th century you would recognize the Quakers by the bonnets that the women wore. And while they're in Quakerism, the Quaker church becomes deeply involved in abolition. And so the Grimke sisters are kind of pulled into abolition and eventually themselves convert to abolition. And start speaking in the 1830s. They have a very famous speaking tour in the 1836-1837 speaking year. And they go around and they start preaching about abolition. But at the time, in the 1830s, women are not supposed to be out in the public preaching. A, women's influence is supposed to be passive. They're not supposed to be aggressive and assertive and dominant. And they're not supposed to be speaking to anyone other than other women. But because these sisters come from South Carolina, and they know something about slavery, they've actually seen it, whereas a lot of the northern abolitionists are just conjecturing about slavery. And at this point, people in the north are super curious about slavery, right? Too, they want to hear about it. So men start sneaking into their lectures. And as men start sneaking into their lectures, and as they start lecturing more widely and get bigger and bigger audiences, the church and other people, not the Quaker church, but others, come crashing down on these women and critique them for being outside their sphere and for not following the Pauline dictate. Paul says women should be silent, and for not following the Pauline dictate of women being silent. And they are harassed, and at one point, Angelina Grimke, and I should just point out, this was not for the faint of heart to go do what they did. At one point, Angelina Grimke has the hall in which she's speaking is set on fire, and she barely escapes with her life. So this was the opposition against them was intense, and they were really the first women to speak to mixed sex audiences. Which, has anyone heard what they were called in the 19th century? So they're attacked for speaking to promiscuous audiences. You couldn't have men and women together in the congregation, in a lecture, because that would lead to promiscuity. And so those were the Grimke sisters. And what happens to them is that they start writing some of the very first women's rights tracts in the 1830s. And remember, this is before 1848, right? Which is what I meant by there's lots of women's rights activity going on before 1848. There's no reason why the first convention has to be the beginning of the movement. They start writing tracts defending women's rights. Sarah Grimke will write in 1838, Letters on the Equality of the Sexes, one of the first women's rights tracts in the United States, one of the first kind of meditations on women's rights produced by a U.S. woman. And Angelina will go on and write a whole bunch of really important pamphlets about women's rights as well. One of the super interesting things about the Grimke sisters is that they were better on intersectionality than some of the other folks. The Grimke sisters will always, in their writings, say we have to recognize the humanity and the equality of black women over and over and over again. And this will get completely lost in the white feminist movement that will come. But the Grimke sisters were constantly insisting upon recognizing the humanity of black women and bringing them into the movement. And just one other thing about them is because they came from a slaveholding family, and as you know, white slave owners were often raping black women, and the Grimke sisters had some biracial relatives. Their brother had a variety of children with one of his slaves. And they go down south and get those children and bring them north and educate them. And they are some of the first men to ever graduate, African-American men to graduate from Harvard. Archibald Grimke will go on and become one of the nation's leading black ministers. Sarah and Angelina will make sure that he gets a college education, and he will go to Harvard and graduate and become a super important African-American statesman. So you see a kind of very different model for what was possible. Yeah.
There is a historical novel for non-historian people like me, the one called The Invention of Wings. I don't know if you know this.
I don't know that one.
It talks about the Grimke sisters and the, now I forget which one of them, was given a slave for her birthday.
Yes.
And,
as young girls,
to talk about their life in the North. And
As
I said, for people who have difficulty with getting into hard history, it's a nice...
That's great. Yeah. It's called... Say the name of it again for everyone and for me. The name again of the novel?
It's called The Invention of Wings.
The Invention of Wings, W-I-N-G-S.
Wings. It's by the same... you might have heard The Secret Life of Bees.
Oh, yeah. Sue Monkkid, I think, or something. Yeah. There's another novel called Sex Wars by Maeve Binchy, which kind of tells the story of Victoria Woodhull, kind of that era. Somebody asked what happened to the Grimkes. I got lost on that. It was a sort of long tangent. So what happens is that Angelina gets married. End of story. I hate to tell you that that's what happens, but Angelina gets married. In 1839, 1840, I can't remember. She starts birthing children and she just disappears. She's not a public figure anymore, nor is Sarah. They just fade from, they don't die until the 1880s. I think one of them dies in 1873 and one of them dies in the late 1870s or early 1880s. But they are never again strong presences. And they had this burst of prominence and glory and then they just disappear. Oh yeah, the Grimkes are totally in the three-volume history. Oh, completely. Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were in their 20s. I'm going to guess they were in their late 20s, early 30s, but I'm not quite sure when they were born. But yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for two women to go by themselves north, this is not an era in which women traveled by themselves. So I think we are probably at time. The story about how women end up winning the 19th Amendment is a fascinating one. I encourage you to check it out. There's going to be all kinds of anniversary stuff coming up because the 19th Amendment is about to have a 100th anniversary in 2020. So you're going to be hearing a lot more about that story. So thanks for your time and energies. I hope this was enlightening in some sense, both about what happened, but also about how the power to tell stories shapes the ways in which we understand the world. That's very much what history is about. It's not just about the truth about the past. So thanks, everyone.